Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. There is a lot of fallout about yesterday's address by the President of the United States in Cairo. We're going to be talking about that in just a moment. But today's program is going to be really, really special because we're going to be talking with author Scott Klusendorf about his book, The Case for Life. And it really will be a fascinating conversation because Scott's done a fantastic work at helping to sharpen the arguments related to abortion. And this new book, The Case for Life, is one that really will help to arm you to understand how to make those arguments. And, you know, many, many times on this program, I come back to the fact that we have to move from assertion, which is saying the right things, to argument, which is the ability to persuade others of the rightness of that assertion. So we're going to be talking about that today on the Albert Mohler Program. And because of the nature of this interview, we're not going to be taking calls today. You're going to be fascinated by this conversation with author Scott Klusendorf. First, let's get back to what happened yesterday in Cairo, Egypt. The conversation that took place there as the President of the United States was speaking to the Muslim people is one that really is going to be the talk, I think, of much around the world for the next several days or so. And I'll tell you why. It's because it was a big speech, 55 minutes long. Now, you know, in a day in which most speeches are reduced in the media to sound bites, a 55-minute speech is really something. And I'll say hats off to the president for that kind of oratorical achievement, to be able to hold the attention of a crowd for 55 minutes talking about the issues that he raised. But I want to go back to something that the president said yesterday there in Cairo. And we're going to listen to what the president had to say. And I want us, because yesterday we didn't have the time for you to hear it in his own voice, I want to go back to it. And I want to raise a very crucial issue. But before I raise the issue, let's listen to the president speaking yesterday in Cairo.
So whatever we think of the past, we must not be prisoners to it. Our problems must be dealt with through partnership. Our progress must be shared. The enduring faith of over a billion people is so much bigger than the narrow hatred of a few. Islam is not part of the problem in combating violent extremism. It is an important part of promoting peace. All these things must be done in partnership. Americans are ready to join with citizens and governments, community organizations, religious leaders, and businesses in Muslim communities around the world to help our people pursue a better life.
And that is a fascinating section of a very complex and fascinating speech. Yesterday on the air, I spoke about what I really felt the speech represented. And on the internet, I spoke of it in terms of the good, the bad, and the ugly. I think there was good in it. And just to repeat, I think the president's affirmation of religious liberty is very important. I think many of the historical points he made were very accurate. I think that the president's statements about Israel in terms of an unbroken commitment to Israel, I think that was very important. But there were other issues that I really found very uncomfortable. When the president spoke to Islam as a religion rather than speaking to Muslims as persons who are the adherents of that religion, I felt that was a dangerous ambiguity that the president threw in. And then it went worse when the president spoke about America's, these are his words, partnership with Islam. I don't think America has a partnership with a religion, certainly not a partnership with Islam. But in the section of the speech you just heard, the president said, Islam is not part of the problem in combating violent extremism. It is an important part of promoting peace. I don't believe that statement is accurate. Now, I don't want to be overheard. I'm not saying that all Muslims are here direct problems in terms of violent extremism. That's obviously not true. It would be a slander and an untruth that would be truly tragic. However, what the president said was Islam. And again, he's not talking about people. I think when the president speaks about a religion, he's really on very tenuous ground, where he should speak about persons, people. But when he says Islam is not part of the problem in combating violent extremism, I just think that's fundamentally on its face untrue. And the reason I bring it up today is to say this. One of the issues for Christians, especially now in the 21st century, to figure out how to talk about these other world religions, and in particular to talk about Islam. And our ignorance about Islam is a real problem here. Most American Christians couldn't define much about Islam other than perhaps coming up with the name Muhammad and saying that they call God Allah and knowing that the book is the Quran. But beyond that, most American Christians know very little. The logic of Islam is so different than the logic of Christianity. And the recognition of that is really, really important. The logic of Islam is not analogous to the gospel of Christ. You don't have Muslims witnessing in the same way you have Christians witnessing about the gospel. The Muslims do not believe that they have good news on an individual basis. They believe instead what they have is the revelation of God through the Quran, which establishes how a society should be organized and how individuals should find themselves under submission to the law of Allah. It's quite a different kind of worldview here. And Islam has to have, at its very center, the motivation to see the entire society come under Sharia law, under the law of Quranic rule. That is very different than Christians, because the Muslim understanding is of a unitary state, a unitary society, in which there's no real distinction between, say, mosque and state, whereas, as you well know, in the United States, there is a clear understanding of a differentiation, not just in order that the church would not trespass on the state, but in order that the state does not trespass on the church. We as Christians understand that we are first and foremost citizens of a heavenly kingdom. And that, again, is very different than what you have in the understanding of Islam, which is to say Christians can be patriots, but we can never see the United States of America as the issue for our discipleship, even as we are thankful to be citizens of this nation and want to be good and productive and faithful citizens, exercising our Christian responsibility in terms of that citizenship. We're going to continue to track the fallout from the speech. As I said yesterday, I'll return to the point, I think the president was doing a net good thing in addressing his larger global audience. It's not just the folks there who are in Cairo, obviously. It's a large global audience about how the United States wants to engage Muslim persons. You might even say the world of Islamic nations. But it's quite different for the president to say that America has a partnership with Islam. We'll be tracking this, and I'm sure there'll be a lot to talk about in days to come. Speaking about things that ought to certainly be on our minds, New Hampshire has now become the sixth state to legalize same-sex marriage. Governor John Lynch on Wednesday of this week signed a bill that authorized same-sex marriage. It's significant, of course, there is now a sixth state. We've talked on this program about what's happening in New England, now the focus of the greatest momentum towards the legalization of same-sex marriage. What makes this particular state's legislation of interest to me today, and I hope to you, is that the governor had ordered that the bill protect members of religious groups, I'm reading here from the New York Times, from having to provide same-sex couples with religious counseling, housing designated for married people, and other services relating to, quote, the promotion of marriage, end quote. But the New Hampshire House of Representatives rejected that language by a two-vote margin. Legislative leaders appointed a committee to negotiate a compromise. The committee last week recommended small changes, further emphasizing the rights of religious groups not to participate in same-sex weddings. They include a preamble to the bill that states, quote, each religious organization, association, or society has exclusive control over its own religious doctrine, policy, teachings, and beliefs regarding who may marry within their faith, end quote. That's just not enough, folks. You listen to that language, it's just not enough. It's not what the governor demanded, and it's not enough to protect, even with that exemption language, the rights of a church or a Christian school or a Christian organization in New Hampshire. We were talking about religious liberty in the Islamic world when we looked at the president's address in Cairo. What about religious liberty in this nation? Just in case you wonder if there are live issues that should have our concern, consider the fact that the New Hampshire House of Representatives turned down the governor's demand for a change in this language, and the governor signed it anyway. The governor signed the bill into law, and now in New Hampshire, we find a sixth state that has approved same-sex marriage. And the governor, having said that he would oppose same-sex marriage, now has signed the legislation. In the middle of those two, he had made demands or changes in the law, got less than he asked for, and he still signed the legislation. That tells us a great deal about where we are. Now the New York Times, by the way, is out with an editorial calling for the state's assembly there in New York to adopt same-sex marriage. The editorial begins, six states have now made it legal for same-sex couples to marry. New York is not one of them. The paper finds that an embarrassment. It ends the editorial by saying New York's legislature has about two more weeks left in this year's session. Their work will not be done until the Senate publicly debates and then votes to legalize same-sex marriage. All eyes on New England on this issue and, of course, furthermore to the nation as well. We'll be back for a really fascinating conversation with author Scott Klusendorf. He's done a great job distilling the arguments about abortion, getting back to what he calls the one central issue, which is the fact that that unborn human being is a human being, a human person, a member of the human family. Once that's established, everything else about abortion really does come into very clear focus. Be armed for the battle. The next few minutes will really help you. We'll be right back with the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Our guest today is Scott Klusendorf, author of the book The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture, out recently by Crossway Books. Scott is also the president of the Life Training Institute, and he has appeared in many different media formats. I want to give the opportunity right now for Scott to explain, why did you write this book?
Dr. Mueller, pleasure to be with you. I wrote this book because I wanted to give rank-and-file Christians the tools of thought they need to make a case for the pro-life view in the public square. You and I both know that in the secular environment that we're in today, some people put Christians on the spot, and they want to force us to justify every single assumption we bring to this debate without, of course, having to justify any of their own assumptions. And I wrote this book trying to take some of the sharpest pro-life thinkers we've got out there, people like Robert P. George, Patrick Lee, and others, J.P. Moreland at Biola, for example, who have written tremendously helpful books that for some lay people may not seem accessible. So I wanted to take the best pro-life thinking I could find out there and put it in a little more easier format for those who maybe don't have time to read a philosophical work.
Well, I think your book is really important, and I want to be the first to express appreciation to you for taking the time to write it. You know, Scott, I'll tell you, one of the biggest issues for me in dealing with this issue now for decades is that too many Christians rely upon mere assertion without ever getting to argument. And one of the best things you model in this book is actually how to get to argument. Assertion's just not enough.
It really isn't. As a colleague of mine points out, he says, for too long the pro-life movement has been shouting conclusions rather than establishing facts. And in a world like ours today, where people make pro-life claims and then don't back them up, the public hears that and says, well, that's nice that that's your opinion, but why should I believe it? And whether we like it or not, the burden of proof is on us to justify why we believe our position is true. Now, philosophically, we can make the case that they bear an equal burden of proof, and that's true. But in a world where our view is viewed kind of as the one that's not the rational one, we're going to have to step up and give actual arguments for our case.
You know, the only thing I would correct in what you just said there is that when you use the word rational, most of the arguments used in defense of abortion are not rational arguments. They are emotivist arguments.
Oh, I agree completely. But unfortunately, the public sees that as being rational. They think, well, that's what the media is saying. That's what politicians are saying. Of course, it's okay to talk out both sides of your mouth and say, I personally oppose abortion, but if you want to have one, that's fine. Or, I want to reduce the number of abortions, but the politician never says why he wants to reduce the number of abortions. And it's that kind of disconnect between what the public feels about abortion and what they rationally can defend that I'm trying to address in the book.
I want to bring in another author, in this case one much revered but not now alive, that's C.S. Lewis, just for a little worldview analysis here. It was C.S. Lewis who argued, using the metaphor he called men without chests. And right. In The Abolition of Man, he speaks about the fact that what we have in this generation are human beings whose minds, that is the rational capacity, is disconnected from the emotions, which is what he would identify as as the stomach, more or less, when and that follows a good historic physiology, getting back to everything from butterflies in the stomach to all the rest. And he said, look, if the gut is where the emotions are located and the brain is where the intellect is located, we have to have a connection between the two. Otherwise, we have people making decisions basically out of the gut. And, that's exactly the way I think most Americans make decisions. It's an emotivist response. I like this position better than that position. And when it comes to abortion, and let's just be honest, Scott, there are too many people who have the right assertion. They hold the right position, but their argument is often emotivist as well. And this gets back to where pro-lifers often think the best argument we have is an emotional argument. And I just don't believe that's true. Not when you have to deal with this in the public square.
I agree with you completely, and let me give you an example of an emotivist argument. You'll hear a pro-lifer say, for example, well, you know that baby has a beating heart at 3 weeks, and why would you want to kill a baby that has an already beating heart? That actually is a distortion of our view, and it's designed to get at the emotions instead of getting at the true reason why Christians oppose elective abortion.
Because that true reason has to go back before there is a discernible
heart. Exactly. You and I do not oppose abortion because of certain levels of fetal development. We oppose abortion because it unjustly takes the life of a defenseless human being at any stage of development.
Absolutely.
That's what we oppose.
Absolutely. And, I would tell you, your book is worthwhile, and it's more than worth its cost, just for page 19. And you really distill there, especially in the italicized text over the paragraph where you begin. You say the abortion controversy is not a debate between those who are pro-choice and those who are anti-choice. It's not about privacy. It's not about trusting women to decide. It's about forcing. It's not about forcing one's morality. It's about one question that trumps all others. And you are exactly right about that question. So what is the one question that trumps all the others?
What is the unborn is the question that trumps all others.
Absolutely.
And in that page that you described there, I'm debating Dr. Nadine Strauss, who was the president of the ACLU up until a few months ago, and she held that post for, I believe, almost 25 years. And she and I have debated this issue, and we're going to do it again at the University of North Carolina coming up this fall. But she was arguing that women had a right to fundamental religious liberty, and that entailed abortion rights. She was arguing that women have a right to privacy, they have a right to their own autonomy, and so on and so forth. And I stood up in front of that audience and said, I agree with everything Nadine just said. She's absolutely right if what? If the unborn are not human beings. And if she can present a case tonight using science to show us that the unborn are not members of the human family, and philosophy to show us that even if they are, we have no duty to value them, I'm open to hearing her claim. But I won't let her get away with simply assuming the unborn are not human, which is what every one of her points did.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is where the focus of the argument is the big issue here, because if indeed, and this gets back to President Obama in his now infamous address, at least infamous to me, at the University of Notre Dame, where, as I argued when I responded in the press about this, he didn't talk about abortion. He talked about talking about abortion.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And he kept using this word, we have to come to consensus, without ever answering the question, does the word we include the unborn? He
absolutely
simply assumed it does not.
But, that is the real issue. And in your book, you make this better than I think anyone I've read has made it. And that is that the singular issue, the only issue to which we have to give our first and foremost attention is the actual nature, character, or as a theologian I would say, ontological existence of that
right.
human being at every stage of development. And that's the one thing those who argue for a pro-choice or pro-abortion position, whatever they want to characterize it, cannot face straightly. They can't face it straightforwardly, because if they did, they would have to abandon their arguments.
They would, because if you look at just the science involved, the kind of thing the unborn is a member of the human family. The unborn are not parts of other human beings the way that skin cells are that I might pluck from the back of my hand. They are rather themselves distinct whole living organisms. They're at an earlier stage of development than you and I, but the kind of thing they are ontologically is not in dispute, and anybody who would take us to task on this is going to have to do battle not only with you and I, but with the science of embryology.
Well, hold that thought for just a moment. We're going to get right back to talking about the science behind this, and this will be really, I think, encouraging to Christians making the pro-life argument. We're going to give you some information that will really be helpful in framing an argument that you too can present in the public square. We'll be right back with the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. My guest today is Scott Klusendorf. He's the author of the book, and I want you to have this book, and I hope you'll certainly be commending it to others. The book is The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. Scott, when we went into the break, we were talking about science, and this is where a lot of Christians feel directly intimidated.
And they don't have to when it comes to the kind of question, what is the unborn? In dealing with the ontological status of the unborn, and I'm glad you chose that word because it's the appropriate one. When dealing with the ontological status of the unborn, the science of embryology does give us a set of facts that are very stubborn. And those facts indicate that the unborn are one of us from the very beginning.
So let's talk about that. I want to isolate this.
Sure.
And I'm going to do it by asking you a couple of questions.
Sure.
And you have done the work to be able to answer these questions. The human embryo is called a human embryo because it can become only one thing.
That is correct.
In its development.
It can only become what it already is, a member of the living family known as Homo sapiens, human beings. Two human parents cannot produce offspring that is not human but later becomes human. Biogenesis, a very simple law in science, says that living things reproduce after their own kind. Dogs produce dogs, cats produce cats, and humans produce humans. So to say that the unborn is human is factually correct and not open to a contrary view, because the science of embryology has clarified what that thing is from the very beginning.
And you know, Scott, the science of embryology has also clarified one other thing that is very essential to the argument, not only about abortion, but embryonic stem cell research, and that is this. The human person cannot begin at any other stage than the embryonic.
Absolutely. In fact, one reason why people get confused on this, Dr. Mueller, is they assume a parts view of human beings. And let me give you a brief example of this. If you and I went to Bowling Green, Kentucky, and visited the Corvette plant there, we would not say that there is a Corvette present as soon as you weld the first two plates together. In fact, we probably wouldn't say there was a Corvette present until the car was just about ready to roll off the assembly line and make functional contact with the road. And a lot of people view the human embryo as a thing that is constructed the way that a car is, not a thing that develops itself from within the way the embryo does. And that's the key mistake that they make. Embryos aren't constructed from the outside part by part. We know scientifically that the embryo does what no part thing could ever do, and that is direct its own internal development to the place where it is ready to emerge as a baby as we know it.
One of the good things you do in your book also is you bring in the right authorities, and one of them is frequently heard on this radio program. A frequent guest is Robert P. George of Princeton University. I want to cite the very passage you cite on page 35 of your book, where he says, human embryos are not creatures different in kind from human beings. They are rather human beings, distinct living members of the species Homo sapiens at the earliest stage of their natural development. They differ from human beings at later developmental stages, not in virtue of the kind of entity they are, but rather by the degree of development. End quote. Now, as Robert P. George says, these facts are stubborn. There's no running away from them.
There is no running away from them, but boy, you will see people try. You'll hear people say things like, well, what about the fact that this embryo can split into two? There's the whole twinning issue. But I think there's a great example here we can point out. The fact that an entity may split does not mean it wasn't a whole living member of a certain species prior to that split. For example, and this is an example that Robert George and Patrick Lee have used, if you take a flatworm and cut it in half, you end up with two flatworms. But it doesn't follow there was no living flatworm prior to the split. So the fact that the embryo may indeed split at an early stage of its development does not mean it wasn't a whole living member of the human family prior to that split.
You know, and to tell you the truth, Scott, the whole twinning argument to me lacks cogency. It's an act of intellectual desperation, because it gets back to the other point that I want to make every time I come back to the actual status of the human embryo. If indeed the embryo does divide, it can only divide into two human embryos.
That's right.
It's not as if it can become some, you know, to use the Latin, tertium quid, some third thing. It can only be what it is.
That's right.
We're going to come right back to Scott talk with Scott Klusendorf about his book, The Case for Life. And when we come back, I'm going to ask him to kind of switch to the other side for a moment. I want him to make the arguments that he knows the pro-choice, pro-abortion side is making, and then we're going to see how best to answer them. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. One of the problems with many pro-life advocates or would-be pro-life advocates and with many evangelical Christians in general is that we are afraid the other side is going to have really powerful arguments we're going to have difficulty refuting. Let me just give you some assurance here. That's not really the case. The best way I know to do this, and I often do this in the classroom as I teach, is I invite students or even require students to make the best argument against their own position. That's where you really find out how strong your argument is. Scott Klusendorf is my guest today. He's the author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. Scott, let's do a little equipping. Let me ask you to switch sides, and you be the pro-choice, pro-abortion advocate here. Make the best case you can make.
I would make two cases. I would go one that's based on emotion and one that's based more on a philosophical premise. The two emotional arguments I would throw at my pro-life friends would be the rape issue and the back alley abortion issue. The rape issue, of course, being this. How can you pro-lifers claim to be compassionate to women and force them to give birth to children that will remind them forever of a sexual assault? And my question, the way I would respond to that as a pro-lifer, is to simply ask the person this question. How do you think a civil society should treat innocent human beings that remind us of a painful event? Is it okay to kill them so we can feel better? Now, that right away gets us back to the issue we began with. What is the unborn? Because unless you begin with the assumption the unborn are not human beings, what you're doing then is simply saying that one human being can kill another if it will make that other human being feel better. Well, that's an absurd argument. So we want to get it back to the question, what is the unborn? The back alley argument, everybody who's at work has heard this one, whether it's around the water cooler or on a break somewhere. The person says to you, as a pro-lifer, I don't understand how you could hold your position knowing that women will die at the hands of back alley butchers if abortion is ever made illegal again. And notice that this too, Dr. Mueller, assumes the unborn are not human, because otherwise the person is arguing that because some people will die attempting to kill others, the state should make it safe and legal for them to do so. I don't know, but I mean, should we make bank robbery legal so that those that want to do it can do it safely? Obviously, again, it's only by assuming if the unborn aren't human does this argument work. Not to mention, there never was a time when women were dying by the thousands each year from back alley abortions. That's a myth. But just taking it on the moral and philosophical level, you can only make that claim if you begin with the assumption the unborn aren't human.
You know, when you make that argument, Scott, I have to come back and just throw a little bit of history into this. The first wave of abortion as a controversy in America can really be traced to New York City and can be traced to the very issue you're talking about, and that is back alley abortions.
That's right.
And the crusading newspaper against the practice of abortion was none other than the New York Times. And the New York Times crusaded against back alley abortions, not by arguing that abortion needed to be made safe, but by arguing that the immorality of abortion needed to be confronted head on, lest women be susceptible to the argument that the way to deal with their pregnancy was by abortion, and they'd be victimized by back alley abortionists. They literally were back alley abortionists. You know, it's amazing now that we have the complete world thrown upside down, where the New York Times will come out and suggest that the way to deal with back alley abortions is to make abortion safe. You know, put quotation marks around that, because, of course, the only moral agent they're concerned with there is the woman, not the child, for whom the abortion is anything but safe.
That's right. They again assume the unborn are not fully human, and that gives that argument emotional force for the population as a whole. But you're right about another thing. In the 1860s and early 1870s, the New York Times and other newspapers in this country were all over the place discouraging women from having these illegal abortions, and they were confronting many of the arguments we're confronting here today. It seems, though, that our press has forgotten that we had these debates once before.
Well, and I guarantee that the press does not want to deal with the central argument of your book. And by the press, I realize there's diversity there, but the mainstream press is so overwhelmingly committed to a pro-abortion position. And they do so on their editorial pages and also by their reportage and in the papers and in the broadcast media. You know, Scott, when it comes down to the central issue, we've got to talk about one solitary issue. This is where you begin your argument. It is the classic, I think, just tremendous punch of your book. And that is, we've got to go back time and time again from where they want to have this discussion back to the status of the human in the womb, or for that matter, in the Petri dish.
And you're right, Dr. Mohler. If we don't focus like a laser beam on the question, what is the unborn, we will end up chasing rabbit trails all over the place from people who want to change the subject on us. And I agree with you completely. The press doesn't want to talk about the question, what is the unborn, but neither do many of the other people we know who are well-intentioned but who are not intellectually strenuous enough to say, I'm not going to dodge the real issue, I'm going to go for it head-on. Well, most people don't want to go for it head-on. They simply want to take the easy way out and go for those arguments that have the most emotional pull to them.
Well, that's the easiest argument to make. And you know, I teach in a theological seminary, and one of the things I always talk about, I just wrote a book on preaching. Preaching has an emotive element. There's no doubt about it.
Yes.
You're communicating to people. Aristotle well understood in terms of his rhetoric that, you know, you're reaching pathos. You're reaching
right.
The feelings of persons. And as composite human beings, there's no way we can leave our feelings on the table. The problem is, if we are merely reaching emotions, we leave people susceptible to the next person who captures their emotions.
That's exactly right. In fact, feminist Naomi Wolf, who is not a friend of the pro-life movement, made a very interesting point in a New Republic article. She wrote that when pro-lifers show images of aborted fetuses and pro-choicers try to dismiss those images as being merely emotional propaganda, they are dodging the real issue here. What the pro-choicers ought to be dealing with, says Naomi Wolf, is what is being killed in the act of abortion. And if the pictures help us understand that, in the Socratic quest for truth, we ought to admit them as evidence. And to her credit, Naomi Wolf says, look, let's stop pretending these aren't real deaths. Let's stop pretending that abortion is something it's not. So there is a proper place for emotion, the pathos as you described it. The pro-lifer, though, needs to be careful that he doesn't use emotion in place of good reasons, but he uses emotion as a valuable adjunct to the rational argument that he's making.
Scott Klusendorf's book is entitled The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. Scott, how can folks find out more about your ministry at the Life Training Institute?
They can go to prolifetraining.com and they can find out what they need right there, prolifetraining.com.
Folks, we talk about a lot of books on this program. I got to tell you, this is one you simply need. The book is The Case for Life by Scott Klusendorf. Scott, what an honor to have you on the program today.
What an honor to be on. Thank you, Dr. Mohler.
We'll be right back with final thoughts for the Albert Mohler Program. You know, I want to go back to where we began in this conversation today. There's a difference between assertion and argument. So let me just clarify that for a moment. An assertion is where you say, this is true. And, for instance, an assertion would be, abortion is immoral. Abortion is wrong. Abortion is murder. Abortion is the killing of an unborn human being. I believe in all those things with all my heart. I also believe that as essential as getting the assertion right is, it's equally important to have an argument behind it. We're living in an age in which we're really trying to reach the hearts and minds of Americans. And this is true on college and university campuses. This is true just talking to our neighbors. This is true in the workplace. It's true in an awful lot of contexts where we really do have to come up with the right argument. We're talking to people we need to recognize who are intelligent. They do respond to issues and controversies like this with their emotions, with their rational capacity, with their intellect, with their reasoning. We need to be there with the material, the arguments to give them things that will really force them to think about the most important question related to abortion. And Scott Klusendorf, the author of the book, The Case for Life, he's exactly right, and you heard him in the interview today. The central issue is who, what is this unborn human being? The focus has to be on the status, the identity of the unborn human being. We used a big word talking about this, the ontological status. That means what it actually is. That's an unavoidable philosophical term. It may be a whole lot more than you want to carry to your neighbor, but let me tell you, the assurance is this. We know what, I prefer to say who, the unborn human is. A human being. And that means a human person. A member, as Scott Klusendorf said, of the human family. Once we know that, we're really armed with the kind of argument we need, because we need then to be able to defend that assertion. We need to be able to make the argument, and Scott Klusendorf does a great job of arming you to make that argument in his book, The Case for Life. And we need to understand the arguments that are going to come back at us. Let me give you a bit of confidence. The arguments for the pro-choice or pro-abortion position, however they want to call it, those arguments all avoid the central issue. And that's why when they say they're talking about abortion, they're really never talking about abortion. They're talking about abortion, or they are talking about what they don't want to focus on, because if they did focus on this question for 1 minute, all their arguments would fall apart. What is killed? Who is killed in the abortion? What kind of life is ended? It is the life of a human being, the life of a human person, the life of a member of the human family. Once that is taken into consideration, all the arguments for abortion fall into absolute irrelevance, because you can't use that argument about any other human being, human person, member of the human family. Folks, this is just a reminder to us that Christian faithfulness in this age requires thinking Christians, ready to think Christianly. I'll meet you next time for Intelligent Christian Conversation.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.